Thank you to President Byford for sharing that ambitious plan with us. My name is Sarah Kaufman. I'm the Assistant Director of the NYU Rudin Center for Transportation. We are going to invite a panel of esteemed civic leaders up on stage in a moment. First, I would like to take a minute to thank some of the many people who helped organize this event, from the Regional Plan Association, Danny Simons, Kate Slevin, Chastity Cooper, Christina Cata, Vanessa Barrios, and from the Rudin Center, Kieran Lutfiali. And, of course, the co-sponsoring groups, of which there were many, who helped organize this event. So thank you all very much. Now we'll have a panel of five esteemed civic leaders who are going to dive a bit more into the specifics of the plan with President Byford. So thank you very much for listening to their questions. And following this discussion, we will have an audience Q&A. And so save your questions until that point, please. On this panel, we have Tom Wright, the president of the Regional Plan Association. We have John Raskin, the executive director of the Riders Alliance. Julie Samuels, the executive director of Tech NYC. Angela Pinsky, executive director of the Association for Better New York. And Chris Pangalinan, who's program director at Transit Center. So thank you all very much for participating, and we'll start off with some questions from the panel.
Is this on? Yeah. Thanks, Sarah. It's been a pleasure working with you and Rudin, and thanks to all the other partners here. And I'll say in particular at RPA, the staff have been wonderful on this, and we have a lot of members of our board here, and thank you all for coming and joining us. Andy, that was a fantastic presentation. Each time, I think it gets better and better. And what I'd like to do, and from RPA's perspective, of course, we've been talking and looking at the signal system for a long time, and I think the emphasis on this is something that really excites us. At the same time, we've kind of seen how long it's taken for the signal systems to be implemented on the two lines that we've seen. So I'll kind of ask two questions to drill down on this. What's going to be different this time? How are we going to be able to implement these changes this time in a more rapid delivery way? And also maybe one of the things we're really excited about is how you're reprioritizing where you're doing it and kind of tackling that big Megillah of the Lex line at the start. I think from our perspective, kind of understanding what that's going to mean, what the transformation will be for riders, for the riding public when they see something like that, would be something we'd like to drill down into a little bit more. So if you could talk about that for a moment.
Sure. Well, the key thing for me, and for various reasons, these two projects, particularly the line we're doing at the moment, Line 7 Flushing, has had various problems. And I think it comes back to that point I was making up on the stage just now, that I believe that what's held us back is we have this tendency to customize everything. And it doesn't just relate to signal systems, but also even things like elevators. We end up with absolute state-of-the-art elevators that are unique to New York City Transit, when I think we've got to get much better at buying cookie-cutter solutions so you simplify the product, and that you can, I think, leverage better prices from contractors as well, because you say, right, for a signaling system, this works in Shanghai or somewhere. I want one of those. Go and get me one and install it. And I think we've got to get better at letting contractors do what they do best. So again, not customizing, but that work to their specifications. I think we have to have a better dialogue with communities in advance about what we're asking of them in terms of outages so that we can get the work done. I think we have to hold contractors to greater account. So I'm a great believer in incentives if you do a good job and that you deliver on time or preferably early, but punitive liquidated damages if you don't, because that really focuses the mind of a contractor. I think we also need to look more imaginatively at different delivery models, at not just designing everything in-house and design bill, but designed build finance, but also look, or design bid build rather, but look at design build as a concept. So we actually transfer some of the risk to the private sector, and we say, okay, you go and design this, and then you go and build it to your time frame. Don't try coming back and saying, oh, we're going to need a bit more money because we got the design, or the design was wrong. Well, you designed it, so you can't use that as an excuse. I just think we need to simplify that agenda and, again, cut out some of the interfaces that we've got that have dogged certainly the 7 line. We cannot continue the way we're going, whereby we just don't deliver on our promises and where we've been dogged by software issues. So, again, keep it simple.
Great question. We're going to move on to Chris Pangalinan, who, Andy, is to your right.
Thanks, Sarah. And thank you, Andy, for your great presentation. I think we can all agree that the Accelerate Accessibility Plan is perhaps the boldest that the agency has ever put forward on this issue, and so that is definitely to be commended. And I have a question about your ability to bring the agency to be able to execute on that vision. And so as a former New York City Transit employee myself, I know that the agency and all of its employees are really capable of greatness, yet have been mired in doing things the same way for decades. Building 50 new accessible stations, perhaps in 5 years, and potentially 300 plus in the next 15 years, represents a tectonic shift in the way the agency has been doing things, and for an agency that's built, taken 36 years just to build 100 key stations. So funding aside, how are you proposing to overhaul and equip the agency so that it can successfully undertake this worthwhile endeavor and also be able to maintain perhaps 5-6 times more elevators than it has today?
Excellent question. So it's a number of factors. Number one, the point I was just making about cookie cutter. If for example, you were to say to a contractor, here is, obviously you'd go through a bid process, but here is a stretch of line, which is basically the stations are very similar. We want a cookie cutter design, each of those, say, 10 stations, and by and large, it's the exact same design, then I believe that you can expedite the installation. You can also leverage a better price from the contractor. So that definitely, I think, is one of the factors. Another of the factors is that we've got to get better at the way we project manage. We've got to get better in terms of our technical specifications, again, buying things off the shelf. We've got to cut our procurement timeframes, which are ludicrous, and there's a board working group, a board task force that's doing just that, and we believe that we can slash procurement's timeframes and still remain compliant with state law, which obviously we have to do. And also, a lot of the other bureaucracy that goes with designing some of these systems or installing them, that again has to be transformed. And the third element would be we must get cooperation from other agencies. So we do need to have very rapid approvals processes with, say, DOT for where we can put things, where, for example, the elevator emerges onto the sidewalk. We don't have time to have a 1-year debate about where the elevator is going to go. We also need the cooperation of the community and the elected representatives of that community. You know, let's not have some sort of NIMBY debate about we're not having an elevator here because it's a terrorist risk. Sorry, but that's ridiculous. It's completely ridiculous. So everyone needs to pull together if we're to achieve this. So that is, I have to say, and I'm glad to have been asked the question, there are caveats to our plan. It absolutely assumes dynamism on the part of everyone. We could do our bit, and we will do our bit, but everyone's got to be more can-do, right? Everyone's got to want this to happen, otherwise it will not succeed.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's fantastic to hear. Next, we're going to hear from Angela Pinsky, Executive Director of ABNY.
Thank you, President Byford, and thank you for flying across the ocean to answer the call of many New Yorkers with this comprehensive plan. And I echo the sentiments of some of your board members from yesterday that whatever the cost is that you determine this to be, that we need to figure out how to pay for it. It is such a critical part of how the city operates that we need to graduate from moving from crisis to crisis into a sustained transit system of the future. My question is, your plan requires a significant amount of short-term sacrifice for long-term gain by New Yorkers, by commuters, by businesses, and by everyone who comes to the city. The city has a number of these types of discussions with varying levels of success, and the threat of imminent disaster sometimes is not enough of a public rationale. So how can New Yorkers, and we in the business community in particular, help in advocating for this plan and getting this approved and achieving the goals of the plan?
Okay, thank you. Well, I think it's back to that point I made about do nothing is not an option and that things will only get more expensive. And I think one of my board members yesterday made a very good point that ultimately New York can't rest on its laurels. It's not got a God-given right to be the financial capital of the world. There are other competitors out there. And so if we continue to allow our transit system to stagnate and congestion traffic congestion to rise, it will hold New York back. There's a cost to congestion. There's a cost to companies saying, well, we can't operate here and we're frustrated and our employees don't like working here because they're stuck on transit every day. So absolutely, I think business can make that case that it's good business. It will enable the lifeblood of the city. It will keep New York at the forefront of being a financial capital of the world if we invest now. And I think the second way that the business community can really assist is because, as I said earlier on, you've got the brains, right? You're the people that know how the buttons to press, the solutions that can be applied, the people to talk to. You're the ones that can come up with the clever plans, the different ways of funding. And my view would be that no single funding source is going to fix this. I don't think there's a single panacea, you know, congestion charge, good, job done, we've sorted it. I think it's going to be a package of measures. Absolutely, people asked me yesterday, does this mean massive fare rises? Well, no, because you could never cover what we're talking about through the fare box, and neither should you. The fare box is there to cover operating expenses, not CapEx. But what you have to do, what we must do, is come up with an imaginative mix, a sustainable mix, a predictable mix, and an affordable mix of funding mechanisms so that we can make this thing a reality. We can do it quickly, and we can do it in such a way that we achieve the objective, which is what we all want. So, you know, I've deliberately been somewhat provocative in the plan in saying this is what needs to be done. And I knew that would then initiate a massive debate about funding, but I make no apology for that. My job is to improve transit. My job is to flag what needs to be done. The one thing I can't do is raise the funds. I'm effectively saying, okay, here's the plan. Over to you. Do you want it? Yes or no?
Yes.
Yes. Take a vote.
Yes. Thank you. Next next up is John Raskin.
So, yes, we're the ones who asked for it. So, thank you. So, I'm John Raskin. I'm the executive director of the Riders Alliance. We represent many of the transit riders, along with Strap Hangers Campaign and other folks we work with. Do you guys take the train? So, you know, this plan is very impressive. It's bold. It's ambitious. We asked for an honest accounting of what it would take to modernize the subway system so it's reliable, and you've delivered that. I actually think one of the most remarkable things about President Byford's presentation is the shift in attitude from it can't be done to it must be done, which I think is a necessary precondition for actually getting the work done and raising the funds. So on that, I think we've talked a lot about the funds just now, and we will continue to. I think that will be probably the primary public debate. But, you know, we will hold you to the parts of the plan that the MTA can do. You've made ambitious promises, and we'll follow up with you about that. But there are some parts of this plan the MTA can't do. The funding is the one we've been talking about, but, you know, the city owns the streets, and the state controls other legislation. And so I'm curious what you see as the big risks. What are the obstacles that you think are facing you, external more than internal, in being able to accomplish the plan? Because that's what we're interested in helping you fight through.
So I think the risks are that potentially people will be just too daunted by the sort of scale of this plan because it won't be easy. This is a big plan. Lots needs to be done. We've left it rather too long. It's not irreversible. One point I would just add is I do look back at my background, obviously coming from the UK. I did see the tube was in a similar mess 20 years ago. It was the stations were squalid. The signaling system was hopelessly unreliable. The trains were breaking down. It was in an absolute mess. It was embarrassing, to be honest. But now you go to London, it's been completely transformed. How was that done? Through ring fence, so lockboxed, sustainable, predictable, affordable funding, and an absolute iron will to get the job done. So that gives me hope for the future. And in many ways, it's kind of a model of what we need here, which is we do need to have that bipartisan, comprehensive buy-in from all parties, not just political, but other agencies, NYPD, DOT. We need support from all levels of government if we're to make this plan a reality. So to me, the threats are people just being daunted by this and saying, well, let's go for only 50% of the plan. I think there's a real risk of sort of NIMBYism, that people will say, well, we're not having a substation, electrical substation in our neighborhood, when we absolutely need that if we're to upgrade the power to provide the additional trains that CBTC will be able to support. So I'm worried that we'll fall somewhat short of what we could do. Got to have political backing. We've got to have the patience of New Yorkers. This will not be easy to do, but as I've said before, the pain will be worth the gain, absolutely. That it will be transformative. So I think there are risks with the plan. We know that there's a risk for us. There's a risk for me personally, because in setting out a bold agenda, people are absolutely rightly going to hold you to it. We wouldn't have put what we put in here, though, if we didn't think it was achievable.
Thank you. And our final panelist is Julie Samuels from Tech NYC.
Thank you. Thank you so much, everyone. This has been really informative and encouraging. And in particular, I've been encouraged to hear, President Byford, you talk about the change in culture both needed at the MTA and also needed, I would argue, in the private sector and among the citizenry of our city and our region. And one of the things I think a lot about with regard to technology, to CBTC, when you're upgrading the signals, how are you thinking to ensure that we don't put in a system and 50, 60 years from now we find ourselves needing to upgrade that again? How are we able to kind of walk and chew gum at the same time, if you will, to be, obviously we have a dire situation right now, but as we fix those problems, how are we also thinking about how we will continue to fix them, both with regard to the technology, also with regard to the fact that we're talking about fixing a system that was developed a century ago, and in fact, it doesn't always mirror how people get around now, where people live, where businesses are, so how we're thinking about, I hate to bring up the next set of problems when we have such immediate problems in front of us, but I think culturally it's important to think about them.
Absolutely. So, the culture, the new culture at NYCT must be, as I said at the start of my few words, it must be about continuous improvement. So that's not only continuous improvement on the part of the employees and the management, but it's also got to be continuous improvement in the way we do things, but also in progressively upgrading the infrastructure. The worst thing that we could do, to your point, is get this thing done and then do what, I'll be honest with you, do what WMATA did. WMATA, the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority, if you go to WMATA, Washington actually looks pretty impressive, right? I've been there. The subway was built in 1976, and it still looks very state-of-the-art. It looks absolutely fantastic. But the problem they walked into was they built that system. It was all shiny. It was nice and new. It worked well. And then they basically stopped doing the state of good repair, the ongoing state of good repair, the constant renewals that needed to be done. So they got themselves into a terrible mess whereby they are having to have not just weekend closures, but whole week closures, what they call safety surges, because it's got into such a state of disrepair that they have no choice, that the system is falling apart. So what we must not do is do this, get it back to a good state of repair, get it into a modern condition, and then think the job is done and sit on our laurels. So we should be continually looking then for the next iteration on technology. I don't think necessarily there'll be a great sort of leap forward, but we should absolutely be looking to upgrade our systems. Another advantage of a modern signaling system is because it's communications-based, digital-based, you can provide upgrades as the thing goes on. And similarly, the bus network, that's the whole point of why we're doing this bus redesign, because we did leave the bus network as it has been for like the last 50 years. So you've got these circuitous routes that drive people nuts. So we're going to continue to keep that under review. And that's the whole point. It's all about continuous improvement.
Thank you. That's a great point. Because this plan is so ambitious and so broad, we have so many layers to peel back. So we're going to go down the row once more with questions for you. We'll start with Chris.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. I'd like to go back to the accessibility if I can. And talk a little bit about maintenance issues, which of course is a very popular topic. If you look at in Boston and your experience in Toronto, they've made a big push to get up to 99.5% uptime, which is the amount of time the elevators are actually working in service. And here in New York, we're at 96.5%, which sounds good, but it's actually the equivalent of 2 weeks a year when the elevators are not working. And so I would like to know what you are in this plan and what you want to be doing based on your experience in other agencies to get us up to the same standard that Boston is at, of 99.5%, and how can we be delivering that kind of great service for New York riders? Okay.
There's a lot to do. There's a number of reasons why our elevators aren't as reliable as they should be, and we need to get better at understanding the granular reasons, what the root causes, if you like, of why a particular device or a group of devices aren't working as reliable as they should be. So is it a fundamental design issue? Is it the fact that the equipment's very old? And the classic example of the traction elevators at Washington Heights. Is it because they're particularly prone to vandalism, that they're particularly prone to exposure to weather? But whatever the reasons, we've got to get to the bottom of those reasons and design them out. So that's one of the factors. Number two, we have struggled as an agency to attract and retain qualified elevator technicians, because at the end of the day, this is a high-rise city, and so being an elevator mechanic is a good place to be, because you can go to the highest bidder effectively. There's a lot of demand for qualified elevator mechanics. So again, we tried to tackle that. We've looked at what the salary that we pay for elevator mechanics, and the union has worked really effectively with us on this, and we're now, I think, offering a more competitive package and apprenticeships, so that we can get qualified people in the first place and then keep them and provide that career path that I talked about earlier, so that we can assign people who really know those machines, and in some cases the almost the idiosyncrasies of individual machines, to keep them in service. Whatever happens, I do want, we're going to make increasing use of individual scorecards for managers. I do want to see us progressively ratchet up our target. So you'll see that over time in the New York City Transit report that I produced for the board. We are going to stretch ourselves and give ourselves increasingly tough targets. But to do that, we need to get the foundations in place. Otherwise, we're just planning to fail. But I'm not happy about that. We want much higher elevator availability.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Tom?
With the second question, I'll go to the regional issue if I can. As Scott, other people have mentioned, you know, this system is part, it's critical to the functioning of the entire metropolitan region. It's also part of, hopefully, a more integrated transit and mobility network for an entire metropolitan region. We were very excited at RPA yesterday that at the MTA board meeting, not only did you roll out this plan, but there was also discussion of the Long Island Railroad moving to a fare system that would allow city users to start to utilize that system in a better way. We look at things like East Side Access, which will provide a one-seat ride to Long Island Railroad riders, which, of course, transfers how people are riding around on the subway system, too. And so kind of the subway, of course, is in many ways the final piece of the puzzle for the entire commuter rail network system. I'm curious, as you're trying to roll this out, and again, this is maybe getting out a little bit over the skis, but are you thinking about how the system that you envision of the future is going to interact with, integrate, connect to that broader metropolitan system, the PATH, New Jersey Transit? How are all these going to come together, and are there certain things we ought to be thinking of right now as we start to think through that, even as you're trying to kind of fix the guts of the system itself?
So I think we do need to start to think in that term. And one of the big leaps forward, if you like, that will enable us to come up with a more integrated system and a seamless system is the advent of the smart card that we will be progressively introducing over the next few years, because that gives us, if we get it right, and we have to, that gives us the means to enable customers to seamlessly travel between different agencies and on different modes without having to worry about does their card or actually their phone or credit card, does it have enough credit on you? Just you don't even have to think about it. You turn up and go. So I would like to see much greater integration between authorities, so that it's easy to navigate. It's seamless, as I've said. There's one way to pay. It's kind of intuitive in terms of the collateral that we use, so maybe maps that show better integration between modes, even within the city, so better integration between ourselves and the ferries and those elements that we don't run. It's definitely the way to go. It's a very live debate in Toronto at the moment to make sure that again, multimodal approach is taken, that seamless approach to transit. And there again, that's being pulled together. The enabler is a smart card. So we've got lots of hopes for that technology. It's the way to go. And the good news is that one of the upsides in going fairly late in the piece in smart card technology is we will be able to leap fast forward, back to those words, fast forward to an open payment system where you won't even need a card. You'll be able to use your phone or your credit card. So I think that's the glue that will hold it together. And we need to make sure that every aspect of that movement throughout the region is seamless, including fares policy.
Great, thank you. Angela, do you have another question?
Over the years, we've all read or heard stories about the MTA capital construction and about inefficiencies, either unduly delayed construction or construction work that's gone in and then had to be immediately ripped out because of a change order or something like that. And they're all, these stories are originating from policies that govern how the MTA does its capital work. And I don't think that we have the time or the latitude to wait for full reforms of how the authority operates before going into this work, nor would I advocate for that. But given the volume of work that you're proposing here, are there other efficiencies in addition to the design build and the culture change that you were talking about that the fast forward plan is looking into?
Yeah. Absolutely, we've got to get our own house in order. As I said earlier, we take far too long on procurement. We're not great at estimating. We've got some great estimators, but we need more of them. Our procedures are ponderous. They take forever. We are seen as, in some cases, there's two angles to this, or two opposite ends of a spectrum. On the one hand, some contractors probably see us as a soft touch, that once you get into the MTA, it's great. You can leverage all of these variations, and you can leverage extra money out of them and charge for change orders, etc. But then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got contractors who refuse to deal with the MTA, people who say, it's a nightmare dealing with the MTA. We're not even going to bother because their specs are so onerous, and they're picky, and they're fussy, and they can't make a decision, and they take forever to come back on a critical decision. We're not going to deal with them. So thereby, you end up with less competition, which in itself drives up price. So there's so much that we need to address so that we are easier to deal with. We have a much deeper pool of contractors from whom to draw. We have much tighter specifications, but we also allow the private sector to innovate. Quite often, the private sector has really good ideas of ways to do things quickly, imaginatively, sustainably, and yet they're stifled. They're not able to do it because we say, that's not the way we do things around here. So there's such a mindset change that needs to happen, and such a change that needs to happen in our procedures. And all of that is underway with the great work being done by our president, MTA president, Pat Foy. We're deadly serious, and Scott's doing a load of work on this. We're deadly serious about changing the way that we procure and execute major projects.
Great, thank you. In the interest of time, do you have a couple of brief questions, or should we go ahead to the audience? Would you like to ask a brief question?
I'll ask a really brief question that will not get anybody in trouble, and we can move on. I just want to ask you to elaborate on the bus part. You mentioned it, and it doesn't get as much press attention, but more than 2 million people ride the bus every day, and we don't need to focus on it as much because I know you laid it out a month ago, but what needs to be done to fix the bus so that people come back to the bus in New York?
I think where I talk in the subway debate, the biggest, most transformative change is to re-signal. The most transformative change that we can deliver for our bus network is stop messing about and give public transit priority on congested roads. We've got to me, it is It's unacceptable, for example, that one car with one person in it can hold up a whole bus route by blocking the bus lane. So there's too much of that goes on. And I ride the buses, and you just see car after car, delivery truck after delivery truck, sometimes NYPD, sometimes NYCT vehicles, which is embarrassing, parked in the bus lanes. That has to stop. So we've got to, if we're serious about getting people back on the buses, we've got to give them a fighting chance of getting through traffic. And our bus network is the slowest in North America because our streets are the most congested. So let's bite the bullet. Let's give our transit the authority and the priority that it requires, because at the end of the day, you are moving the masses, and surely that should take precedence over individuals in individual cars.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to go to Julie's question, and while Julie is asking, if you have a question for President Byford, please raise your hand, and we have people with microphones who will come to you. So please raise your hand while Julie is asking her question and President Byford's answering.
I'll be really quick. I just want to point out that it struck me when you put up the maps of the lines you're going to start with, that I, who care about the whole system in the city, find myself looking for my lines first. And I'm sure I'm not the only one in here who did that. And it strikes me that so many people personally rely on the subway and the bus system, and there's so much we need to do culturally to get people ready for the fixes. And some of that is cultural, and some of it is logistics. And so much of my community relies on the L train, which is about to be shut down. And I was curious how you're thinking about using that moment, again, culturally and logistically, to ensure that our larger ecosystem is ready for some of this pain.
Well, there's science behind how we've chosen the lines. I mean, the number 6 has been chosen because that's my line. Okay, so that's being done. But no, I mean, I think the L line closure is a good example, actually. It would be a very early test of our tenure and a very early test of as a team in showing how we can get it right. That is not going to be easy. It's huge. It will be the biggest closure I've ever worked on, because A, we're talking a huge number of people, and B, we're talking about a protracted closure. So we're very focused on that. We've had extensive consultation, which I think is a good example of the way we need to go in the future, but we are going to micromanage the run-in to that closure and the execution of that closure. So you'll see lots of people, lots of communication, and we need to be very dynamic about how we manage it once it gets going. So to me, it's a good test case for how things have to go in the future, how to properly communicate, plan for, and execute a major closure. That's going to be a very useful test run, if you like, for what's to come.
Thank you. Now, in the interest of time, we'll have just time for 2 questions, and I believe one person has the microphone back there.
Thank you. First of all, President Byford, congratulations. I think it's a remarkable plan, and I also compliment you on what appears to be your management style, which I think is going to be an essential part of this. So congratulations on that. My question is there going to be a mechanism for, shall I say, established advocacy groups such as John at the Riders Alliance and Strap Hangers and so forth to provide input, not only in this initial part of the plan, but as it proceeds?
I'd say absolutely. And in putting this plan together, I would just like to acknowledge just what great input we had from advocacy groups. We held a couple of sessions with disability advocacy groups. We held some sessions with customers. We held extensive conversations with our employees. Around 4,500 employees contributed to the plan. We held sessions with the unions. We had all the unions, and quite often the presidents, come together for a couple of sessions to involve them in this plan. And I think that is the way of the future. It's a much better plan if it's not some sort of top-down, now hear this imposition, but that it is, it's one that other people can say, well, yeah, I had some input into that. That's partly my plan. I want it to be our plan. And I think the MTA in the past has possibly fallen into the trap of a bit of a siege mentality, and you know, we know best, possibly a slight we know best approach, and seen groups like John's as you know, better not talk to them because they're critical. Well, actually, I prefer to be on the front foot. I prefer not to put up the drawbridge, but to actually say, well, let's go and talk to them. And actually, their criticism is sometimes born out of frustration about not being heard. So absolutely, you can expect to see a much more consultative, inclusive approach going forward, because at the end of the day, ultimately, we're all on the same team, right? We all have a common objective. We all want public transit and this city to prevail.
Thank you. In the back.
Hi, President Byford. Just want to say thank you very much for all of your great ideas going forward. But my one question remains is that there are some culture changes that need to be addressed, particularly sometimes men feel that there's no place for women in transit or in leadership positions of transit. And I was wondering, since you're making these delightful changes, do you have any changes or any placement for women in leadership positions or in internship positions where they can be considered a value and an asset in terms of equality and equity at the table? Thank you.
Well, we have a couple of good examples down here sitting looking at me right now. We've got Sarah Meyer, who's my chief customer officer, who I appointed. We have Naomi Rennick, who's my chief of staff. So there's two women on my executive. I absolutely believe in the benefit of a broad tent, if you like, a diverse executive, and one that should reflect rather the city that it serves and the company that it's employed by. And it should be done on merit. I don't believe in quotas. I don't think that that helps. But absolutely, the policy that I've established in the past is that where there are two candidates of equal merit and one comes from an underrepresented group, that's the divider. That's the point at which you can make you can take positive action. So let me give you an example. The TTC, Toronto Transit Commission, 5 years ago, there had never been a woman on the TTC exec ever. And that goes back to 1921. When I left, on merit, my executive was formed of myself and six men, six women, all appointed on equal merit. And I felt that made for a much more informed debate. So that's the whole point is it should be done on merit. We've also just appointed another woman for the first time ever, to be the senior vice president of Subways, a lady called Sally Librera, who is a superb strategic thinker, and that's why she got that job. So no quotas, no sort of PC thinking that people would just say, oh, you're just doing it to be tokenist. No, I'm doing it for the right reasons. I'm doing it because a balanced executive rather than a homogenous executive makes for better, more informed decision making.
Thank you, President Byford. That's excellent to hear. Unfortunately, we'll have to return this space to the NYU Law School now. So this will be the first of many forums that I'm sure President Byford and New York City Transit will hold about this plan. So you'll have time in other forums to ask your questions. I want to thank the New York City Transit Authority and President Byford for taking the time with us today. Thank you. And thank you to our panelists.